Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Josh Hellman. Josh is one of the most respected product managers in the game, having built products at Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Zazzle, and more. Now, he's made a name for himself at Greylock as a top VC. We talk about his journey working at all those companies, what it was like to work with some of the best founders of all time, his transition to investing, advice for people starting a company, and much, much more. Josh has been a friend and supporter, and if you ever get a chance to work with him, I highly recommend it. He's one of the best at what he does, and he's one of the good guys. All right, here's Josh. Josh, thank you for coming on Protestant Live. It is an honor to have you here.
Cool. Thank you for having me, and sorry for the technical difficulties on my computer.
No. There's a lot we want to get into, career-wise, product-wise, investor-wise.
Awesome.
There's so much to talk to, but let's start at the beginning. When you were in high school and college, what did you think you were going to do? What did you think you were going to become?
You know, when I was in high school, the thing I was most excited about was urban studies, and really thinking about the future of cities and how you could build out cities, and I was going to go to college and study economics and maybe some East Asian studies, thinking that China was going to be a big place of the future. And I thought, between the two of them, I'll be able to kind of figure out how we build the future of our cities. And I started to realize, though, that being in economics and in cities, things move pretty slow. And you could work on a development that might be a 10-year project, or you could work on city regulations and be a city manager. And my brother was majoring in CS at Stanford, and sort of my dad was always into computers. And between the two of them, sort of got convinced that, like, if I really wanted to move fast and really help change stuff, it was going to be much more about getting into technology and the future of that. And that was really happening. And Netscape 0.6 was what I used as a freshman in college. So I kind of switched. I actually switched from Yale to Stanford. I was a freshman at Yale. My parents met at Stanford. My brother was at Stanford. I was like, maybe I made a mistake, didn't follow the family. So I switched over to Stanford, jumped into computers full on, ended up majoring in symbolic systems, and kind of decided that was where I was going to put my time and energy on really making stuff fast. And this was also the heyday of, like, Netscape was coming out, and eBay and Amazon and Yahoo. Those were the big companies back when I was in school.
Career out of being, superlative product manager. When is the moment that you knew? Because you started as an engineer, right?
You know, I don't think there's ever a moment that I said I really want to be a product manager. I think the whole time, though, I want to do one thing, which is work on stuff that, if you get it right, can touch hundreds of millions, billions of people, and really build technology that people bring into their daily lives. And I that was actually what I said in my college resume is my objective when I was looking for my first job in college. I think the one thing I've figured out is, as you build technical skills and as you build products and as you put them in people's hands, the more you do that, there are roles where you can keep creating code and sort of have an impact on one feature in one area, or you can have roles where you can help figure out what kind of code 10 people are going to write, or 20 people are going to write, or 50 people are going to write in order to build that product that delivers it. And so I think my whole career has just been, how can I help get the most products built and the most things written? And as I learn to code and as I ship successful products, could I be more successful helping more people doing that than just taking on a bunch of coding projects myself? So that was really my shift, more from engineering to product management, versus me just waking up one day and go, I want to be a product manager.
You said you wrote this on your objective for college resume?
Or my resume when I was leaving college and, like, applying to jobs. It said, to create great technology that changes people's lives.
And what inspired, sort of, is there, like, a philosophical underpinning or religious underpinning that inspired that, or just sort of what inspires that desire?
You know, I wish I could trace it back to, like, something in my childhood or something with my parents, but I just think, you know, I just always had this dream to kind of, like, you know, it's really interesting to work at scale. I was an intern at Microsoft in 1995, which was, like, the heyday of Microsoft. It was the summer of the Windows 95 launch. And I got to see what happened when you created a company that, you know, their goal was to put a computer on every desktop in every home. And I got to see what happened when you did that and what a company like that became and the impact it could have on the world. And I think that sort of set me in my whole career. I want to have that kind of impact. And yet I always got attracted to the ones that could have that impact from something really small versus just jumping into a job that sort of already was at scale.
How did you find yourself at like the right place at the right time? What was the first moment that you were transitioned from working at a company to working at the?
Yeah, well, look, when I graduated from school, my specific goal was to find a company that had not gone public yet. This was 1997, that I thought had a chance to be huge for the world. And I also kind of wanted to go back up to Seattle. So Amazon had already gone public up in Seattle, but Real Networks, which was doing audio and video, and this like brilliant idea, let's put audio video on the internet, just like we're doing here. But, like, this was the idea back in 1997. I thought that would be a great company to go work at. You know, Real got pretty big for a short period of time, and I came down to the, you know, after 6 years, I kind of saw the writing on the wall that it might not be the dominant long-term company in audio and video. Came down to the Valley and actually started business school and said, oh, I'm going to go to business school because I need to go learn business things in Excel. And at business school, my buddy and I got excited about social networking. And we said, this feels like this could be a really big thing. So first it was audio video for me. Then it was social networking. I cold emailed jobs@friendster.com, jobs@linkedin.com. I managed to get a response from jobs@linkedin.com because I had done the same major at Stanford as Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn. And they said, hey, come chat. And then it was like, why are you in business school? Come here and be a product manager. And put all that together and ended up joining. But I had that thesis that I thought social networking could be big. You know, joining Facebook and Twitter a little bit later in my career might have been, you know, more obvious. By the time I joined Facebook, it was early 2008. The Facebook platform had launched. It was a pretty big deal. But people still didn't predict it would become as big as it has. And I thought this could be the future of the consumer internet, how every product is built on Facebook platform. And then, with Twitter, I looked at Facebook and I said, gosh, Facebook's going to go on to be a great company. But I got sort of itchy to go back to something even earlier than when I joined Facebook and thought Twitter, man, has a chance to be a really big thing, and ended up joining them. And it was always like, whenever I joined, I was like, if this works, there's a chance to be really, really big and important company. And that's kind of always what I set out to go look for.
Reid, like in 2004, 2003, when you first met him, and now you're working with him, 13 years later, what was that like?
What's funny is, getting to know somebody, I think Reid is kind of a pretty big public figure at this point. I mean, he's a founder of LinkedIn, a multi-billionaire. And yet, he's not that different of a person than he was back then. He's always been incredibly strategic. Like when I first met him at LinkedIn, and he told me, here's exactly how LinkedIn's going to evolve. First, we get this network, and we grow the network to a point where everybody has to be in it. Because if you're working professionally, the people that you know are one of the biggest assets that you have. And so we're going to figure out how to virally grow this network. And then we're going to add usage. We're going to build utilities that people can do this to be a better employee or more productive in their own careers or learn to manage their own careers. And then we're going to build revenue products that figure out how to leverage the network in a really meaningful way. And he just like laid out the entire 10-year, 20-year arc of LinkedIn. And like I kind of call him Babe Ruth sometimes. He kind of called his shot and then actually hit it. And yet, like when you talk to him now about LinkedIn, about any of the strategy of the internet, like he's just as intellectual and thoughtful, and mind is always worrying on how things could be better, whether it's a minute little product detail, as he ever has been. And yet, when you kind of realize those dreams, you start to wonder what is the bigger impact you can have on the world. And I see him, pondering that and kind of how does he get sort of next level leverage too.
So let's just say, the Reid of 2003, before that, a professional network didn't exist in the same way, right? Like he really made something new. If he was, before LinkedIn in 2016, what opportunity do you think he would pursue like now?
That's a great question. I think, he's always looking at it from the investment standpoint, because I think the benefit of, being at Greylock is we all get to go, and instead of starting or founding the companies that, in my case, joining the companies I believe could be a big deal, we get to sort of sign up as an investor and a board member for those. I see him excited about the future of Bitcoin, the future of all of us are talking about, what is the future of like humanity and biology and synthetic biology and all the things that are happening there as those start to become more readily available. They are the future of communication platforms. What is next? We've invested in companies that disrupt you know, major industries through mobile products, similar ways to how Uber has done it for personal transport. You know, we're just looking at all these things that could be as disruptive in today's era as social networking was, you know, 10, 12 years ago.
Why can't people mess with LinkedIn? Like, or a lot of people say, don't even try to compete with LinkedIn. You can't. What is network effect just too powerful? Like,
you know, the network effect on LinkedIn is incredibly powerful, and it's not really about engagement. I would say the core premise of LinkedIn is to find or be found. And so for most people in the world, the premise is to be found for the right opportunity, the right job, the right thing you didn't know was coming your way. And LinkedIn has 300 plus million people in the world who want to be found for the right opportunity. And then it has a smaller number of people who are actively doing the finding, whether they're startup founders trying to network to the right people, whether they're hiring managers trying to hire, whether they're business development or sales professionals trying to find the right contact at a company. But because all those people are doing the finding and everybody else wants to be found, it works really well. And it's very hard to go build a new massive network that will have everybody in it in anywhere near the same way that will have everybody wanting to be found. Because if I tell you, Eric, go sign up for 5 new services and have your professional history online and connect with the people you've worked with, you're like, why? I already have LinkedIn.
What was Mark or like some of the exec team like, you know, even the company like, you know, 2008 or when you joined?
You know what's funny is back in 2008, the company was still, you know, things were going incredibly well. The product was growing worldwide. The platform had launched and we'd had, you know, developers get to hundreds of, you know, or tens of millions of users in their products really fast. And yet the company was in this interesting point of uncertainty. Like it knew there was a big deal and it knew there was a big long-term thing that Facebook was going to become, but people didn't know how it was going to make money. They didn't feel confident that there was going to be a lot of revenue that was about to happen. And, you know, I even think as mobile happened, a lot of people were like, oh, this mobile thing, it's important, but not that big a deal. And there was a real then tension over the next couple of years that Facebook was going to miss mobile. And I think the team sort of was still finding itself in that 2008 and 9 era. We launched Facebook Connect. The platform went through a bunch of shifts and people saw all of a sudden Facebook's killing the platform. You know, the iPhone started to become an even better source of distribution than Facebook as their app store launched. And I think there was a set of uncertainty. And what Mark was incredible at doing was making everybody at Facebook feel like they were part of a journey and a mission and sort of a war almost on how to become the biggest, most important company in the world. I remember very specifically a time when sort of the company shifted from like, hey, we got to go beat MySpace to be the most important social platform to, hey, we got to go beat Google to be the most important technology company. And we were not bigger than MySpace when the company made that shift, but we felt like it was inevitable that we would be. We were already going to go set our sights on Google. And, wow. And I think that sort of energy and focus and drive to be the best, you know, really, really has just been a guiding force, you know, within that company. Nothing is too ambitious to go and try to tackle, even though, you know, there's a couple, you know, false starts here and there. You know, move fast and break things was not a concept. It was a mission.
And what about Twitter? I mean, to be there at the time that you were at and to know, you know, work with Evan, Biz, and Jack. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Jack wasn't involved in the company when I joined. I actually never really met him much until kind of the very end when he started to come back full time. You know, when I joined Twitter, you know, I'd come out of Facebook that sort of had this energy, this we can build anything, we can conquer the world. And when I was looking at Twitter, I found myself using Twitter more. I was like, whoa. Facebook's incredible to keep up with your friends, but Twitter, you can be in touch with the whole world. You can see what's going on everywhere. You can feel it, embrace it, be a part of like this fabric of the world that is completely different. And it wasn't tractable or tangible on Twitter, on Facebook. And so I got to Twitter and I thought Twitter was much bigger and the whole world had heard of Twitter by then. It had been on Oprah and people were talking about Twitter in the press all the time. And I got there and I realized it was a very different company than Facebook. We didn't know how many users we had and it wasn't that many relative to Facebook. The engineering had been under such duress because the fail well and just things of like, we can't even get to scale and we didn't have a ton of infrastructure at that time that it was like, how do we fix the infrastructure and stabilize the infrastructure versus we can go build anything and dominate anything. And yet what was amazing from folks like Ev and Biz and Jason Goldman, who was running product at the time, was this idea that if we get Twitter right, it truly is an important voice channel, voice communication for the whole world. And the things that are happening and the things that people are saying on Twitter and this open communication, this open information network is like nothing that we've ever had before. And they're like, we have a mission to actually go take care of that opportunity for the world, and we have to go do it.
And when you joined Greylock, talk about that transition a little bit. Did you know that you wanted to become an investor?
You know, it was actually not nearly as intended. You know, I think by the time I was at Facebook and I'd been through Reel and LinkedIn and Zazzle and Facebook, you know, I had that dream. I'm like, ooh, wouldn't it be cool to be a VC someday? You know, they get to go and sit and make the decisions on which companies to back and not, you know, and I think I always had sort of aspirational. I wish I'd understood what VC was like before thinking it was cool, because it's much harder than I suspected before joining. But I had that sort of aspiration and thought, wouldn't that be fun? And then, but when I joined Twitter, I was like, this is my company. I've already been through enough LinkedIn and Zazzle and Facebook. I've been a couple of years at each of them. I was like, at Twitter, I'm going to ride this thing all the way. I really want to be part of taking a company public. I really just want to become one of the lead product leaders who's just, you know, joins the company early and stays forever. I really respected some of the people who'd been even earlier at me at Facebook, who had risen to great roles of leadership, guys like Chris Cox, who's just exceptional. I'd really respected people I'd seen at Google, who'd still been around Google 10 years later, driving new initiatives. And I was like, I hope Twitter's that company for me when I joined. You know, and then it got to be a little bit of a bummer. I think, you know, there's a book about what happened at Twitter kind of at the CEO level, but Ev was asked to leave. Jason Goldman, Biz Stone ended up leaving, you know, and not being as active sort of, you know, in the 6 or 9 months after that. DeCostolo took over, you know, and then Jack Dorsey came back. And, you know, through all that, I was like, I believe in Twitter. I want to make Twitter something great. I believe this should be everybody's way that they connect with the whole world. I had a bunch of dreams and ideas for the next set of roadmap stuff that I was really excited to help the teams build in the areas that I was working on around growth and relevance. So all of that was me, you know, believing in Twitter. But when Jack Dorsey came back, we didn't click, and it became clear that he wanted his own people in kind of senior product roles, and I wasn't one of them on the train. Got asked to leave the company, asked to resign, I guess, technically, a few months later. And that was July of 2011. And I said, man, what am I going to do? I've been through some of the most amazing companies. Now I no longer have a job at any of them. And yet I wonder if there's the lessons I've learned would help to do something different. And I was just about to be 36 years old. And I thought, man, if I'm ever going to try to be a VC, this might be the time to see if that's a career path for me, or if I should go find another company to go be a part of. And, you know, I'd been fortunate to know both Reed and David Z, who runs Greylock, as well as a bunch of the other partners here over the years, just through interactions. And, you know, I've been working at Facebook, which was a portfolio company of theirs, and we'd help with like a bunch of platform partnerships. So they said, you know, hey, why don't you come and, you know, what do you want to do? And I was like, I'd love to try to learn about VC, see if it's something for me or not. And they said, come here and hang out for a couple of years and we'll figure out if it's a fit. And, you know, the idea was, you know, 2-3 years of spending time at Greylock, helping to find interesting companies. And the default plan was I would go back to get a product job after that. And that was really what I anticipated doing. But a couple of years in,
Snapchat.
Snapchat was one of the ones that I sourced and was encouraging us to invest in. We unfortunately are not invested in Snapchat, but I think I went through the list of companies I'd found and the ways that I was operating in the VC community and thought to myself, I wonder if this would actually be something that I could actually be, you know, do as a career. I mean, VC is a job, just like product management is a job, just like, you know, running a company is a job. And I thought maybe I should stick and try to do this. And the Greylock folks, David and Reed and James and John, were like, hey, we like your style and what you do, and we think you'd be able to invest in some good companies if we actually give you the chance to do that. And putting it all together, it just felt like this was something that I want to do. And, you know, there's a great quote from the musical Hamilton, if you haven't seen it, about, you know, I'm not going to throw away my shot. And this was sort of like me, like, you know what, I have a shot now to get to work with the best founders and help them build their companies and invest on behalf of Greylock and our limited partners, and thought, I'm not going to throw away that shot.
You had one shot, one opportunity.
Got my shot.
So tell me, when you found Snapchat, you saw Snapchat, you built a relationship with Evan, you knew that this was going to be big and the partnerships didn't buy it. What's going through your head at this point? Are you furious?
You know, look, there's a lot of complicated story for how we didn't end up getting to invest in Snapchat. Evan is an incredible founder and I think will be one of the iconic founders of our time. There's a lot of different press or reputation about him, but I think that's all missing the real story of the person he is and the company he's building. You can't invest in everything. And I think the challenge of venture capital is not to invest in every single company you think has a chance, but to find those couple that become your tribe and your portfolio and the ones you really get to bet on. You know, as a non-partner, all I could do in that role was helping me, try to encourage them to see the light. And as we got closer to possible decisions, it was, how can we as a partnership really make this happen? And it doesn't always work out. And it doesn't always work out for founders who want to raise money from certain people, and doesn't always work out for investors who want to invest in certain companies. And you just got to keep on going. Find the next one. Next play.
I worked with Reed, Mark at Facebook, Ev Williams, and gotten to know Evan a bit. These are some of the most, iconic founders of this generation. Talk about the differences when you think about the archetype of an iconic founder. Like, what are the differences between those four? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. What all the great founders have that I've gotten to work with have in common is a recognition of the luck they've had that's gotten them in a position to build something that's world-changing. So look, everybody starts in the same place. I want to build this cool thing. I want to build, Reed was like, I want to build a professional network that we connect professionally. And, Ev Williams was like, hey, look, this Twitter thing, I built Blogger and, Odeo didn't work. And hey, this Twitter thing that, Jack and Biz started actually seems to be working. Or, obviously Marcus started Facebook on college and like, whoa, it's taking off. But what happened kind of partway down the journey of all of these things is they realized now that this thing's working, it can be a really important company for the world. Now that Twitter was starting to have this sort of microblogging traction, I think Ev Williams and the team there realized, whoa, this could actually be a really important news network for the world. I think the Facebook folks, there's stories of the Facebook folks wanting to deviate and work on something called WireHog that was like a better Napster. Weren't even sure if Facebook was actually going to be the big thing they ended up doing, but you saw that at some point pretty early, Mark clicked and realized connecting the world might be the single most important idea, and that this might actually become, the future product. And so, it takes that luck to get going, but each one of those folks, once they saw it, they then were able to really articulate that vision and drive the company all the way there and make really thoughtful decisions every step of the way on whether they thought they could help the company get there.
One of the reasons you're one of the most beloved VCs in tech is because you are a advisor and mentor to so many. And in one of the situations in which you advise a mentor is when people should start either start their own thing or leave something to join something else, sort of big career decisions. And you are a fascinating person to talk to about it because you have been at three of the biggest companies, most successful tech companies, and you've left after a couple years at each one, give or take. What looking back, how do you make sense of, one, your philosophy on, when to leave something and join something else or start something, and or your just general, looking back at your own path, how do you make sense of, because you could say, oh, you could have stayed at this one, but then you wouldn't have been at Twitter, or wouldn't have been at Facebook. Like, you joined iconic companies.
Well, look, I think the first thing I always say is like, do as I say, not as I did, because I moved a little too much, and to have been as lucky as I was to move around as much as I did and still end up at really iconic, really successful companies is a super high degree of difficulty maneuver. And I bet you if I were trying to build my career starting from scratch, even with the same tools or knowledge that I have now, I doubt that I could even repeat that. So look, I think the dream is try to find that one great company you believe in, you believe can get big, you believe where your job gets better and different and grows more every year, and you really believe you're still on a mission to something great. And if you find that, enjoy it, stick, grow in the company, have a great time. Don't necessarily sit there and go, oh, I should leave to go on to the next company like I did. Don't always say, I want to be more senior. Why am I not the VP yet? That was one of my mistakes in my career, was that I would think to myself, why am I not running the show? And I'd spend more time kind of getting caught up on that than thinking about, like, how do I do such great work that a year from now or 2 years from now, they're asking me to take on a lot more responsibility. So patience, there's this urgency in our careers. I should be a founder tomorrow. I should be a CEO tomorrow, that I think, you know, I wish I had a lot more patience in my career. I never should have left LinkedIn, for example, although I realized I didn't love the HR space. So that's sort of the first thing I tell people is, you know, when they're thinking about their job and whether they should go somewhere else or not, is always go to something new that you think is a bigger, better chance for you to be involved with something important. Don't just leave your current job because you're dissatisfied. Because you have to look at your current job and say, if I just stay here, as long as they don't fire me, which we can come back to that, as long as they don't fire me, if I keep staying here and doing and growing with this company, is my job going to get more interesting, more fun, more exciting? And if you believe that, then, and I'm going to be part of something that's a very big impact on the world, I highly encourage people to stay. I think it's really, really important.
Well, let's come back to that, because that's a fear of many people, is getting let go. How have you sort of navigated that in your own career? What do you advise to people who come to you?
There's two ways people get fired. One is they get fired or asked to leave specifically for their own performance or their own fit at the company. The second is when they get laid off as part of the company has to restructure and do this. Both of those suck. They're very different. You know, in the first one, if you get fired in the first case and you didn't see it coming, you need to really self-reflect on what you were doing wrong or what you weren't doing at the company, so you can go back and figure that out. Because if you can't understand why that happened, that's a problem, and it should never be a surprise. And you should know, I'm not doing my best work. What are the situation I need to do my best work to feel great at my job? Because at the end of the day, we should all be able to stay there. You know, in the second case, there's sometimes not much you can do about it except for you to detect the company may or may not be succeeding, and then again, find one that's more interesting. But that's sort of on the negative side. On the positive side, the way I always thought about it is, I always had a list of the companies that I would love to be a part of that I thought could be really big and important for the world if I wasn't at my current one. And so, you know, I always had my own list, and everybody should have a list, and it should be ranked. And you'd be like, look, if you weren't working at your current job, what is the one you should go work at? Like, what is the one you think you'd have more fun that you, and by the way, that I think you think can be 10x bigger. Like, I like to think about, like, the company can be 10x bigger from where it is today, whether that's in revenue or users or usage, but there's something that there's a 10x shift. Because if you can get a job at a company that's going to have a 10x or more shift, your job's going to get bigger and more interesting immediately. So that's sort of, you know, have that list, keep that list. Work the relationship so you know some people at the company. So in the worst case where you do get fired, you can say, hey, I wasn't doing my best work. This wasn't the fit. This is the type of job that would be awesome for me, and I would love to come join you in that role if you think that's possible. Let me add one more really important thing is, no matter where you are, even if you risk getting fired or you want to leave yourself, always do great work and make sure you'll have great references from at least some people in the company. Like, if you really are in a situation where you think nobody likes you, nobody likes your work, you're not going to have any good references if you leave, like, leave immediately, because it's really hard to go get future jobs in the Valley without people who are your backers and advocates. I mean, Reid Hoffman, I left LinkedIn way too early, but because I'd done work that I was proud of and that he was happy with in the early days of LinkedIn, he still referenced me well across my career and brought me back into Greylock. So that's just one example.
You didn't start a company in the traditional sense. Do you think we overvalue starting companies? Like, what do you think about that?
That's a great question. Look, my whole career, I was a joiner. I was an early joiner and joined things I thought could be a lot bigger with some founder who'd taken the risk and built the company. And I love being a joiner, and I'm pretty proud of the career I've made as a joiner. And I think as a VC, it's kind of like peak joining. Like, I get to join at the board level and I pay a lot of money to go get those jobs now. You know, look, I think founding is powerful. I think if somebody has a dream, somebody has an idea, somebody wants to start from something very small, and they think this company, this idea should be a really, really big deal, you should totally go found a company. But it's a life decision. It's not I can be a founder or I could be a product manager. Like, these are not either or. This is like apples and oranges. if you have to found a company because if nobody else founds this idea, then it won't happen, or it might happen by somebody else, but it's really important and your idea is the way to do it, you should totally found a company. But if you're founding because it sounds fun, you're not that likely to be successful. None of the founders I've worked with ever just founded a company because they wanted to be a founder. They found a company because they thought that it was just their life mission and the sacrifice they were going to make and the idea that they wanted to get out of their heads. They just had to get a team of people to come with them and make it. And if they weren't doing that, they just don't know what else they'd be doing. Like, that's when you should found a company. If you're not like that, you can make a lot more money and be a lot more successful and have a pretty good work-life balance being a joiner of the right companies at the right time in the right role. There are hundreds of people that made way more money that they'll ever need in their lives from joining Facebook in the early days, much more than all the founders who've gone through different founder accelerators and other programs, just as one example. And I'll bet you the same will be true for Uber and Snapchat and many others.
What's something that you've changed your mind about as an investor, or something that you no longer do that you used to do? Or
yeah, I'm still learning a ton as an investor. I don't know all of the things. You know, one of the things I did early in my career, and I'm in love with all these investments, was bet pretty early on people and ideas that I thought could become really big. One, you know, operator with Robin Chan, who I thought can really go, you know, Robin and Garrett Camp, who's the founder of Uber, can really go disrupt sort of commerce messaging. The ability that you can just ask a question and get a product that you want, like you don't even know exactly what you want, will help you figure that out and actually get it delivered to you kind of over a conversation is a really credible thing. I found as a VC, you know, you take some of those bets where you think it'll work and you're kind of speculating on this incredible team. It's really hard to get anything out of the gate. Or you go and you invest more in things that have a little bit of traction momentum and you're trying to figure out, like, with this little bit of usage, can we make this something that can be really, really big? And I think I'm constantly going back and forth on the pendulum on when to bet on different sides of that equation. And so I think every year I learn a different lesson. Sometimes I learn the lesson of bet on traction. You know, my last investment, Discord, is one that was doing incredibly well and growing really fast when we invested. Or I'll find more that I want to invest really early at kind of concept stage. And I think that's something I'm still learning.
If you were an LP, what signals would you look for in placing an investment into VC firms?
It's a great question. It's a little bit insider baseball for VCs, but I would try to really understand three things about the investors. One is, you know, are they in the right deal flow of the young founders and have a compelling brand that will cause founders to want to reach out to them? Because I think fundamentally, you know, a big part of initial success of VC is being able to have people at least interested in meeting you and having a conversation. And so part of that's hustle, part of that's a brand, part of that's a differentiator. You know, everybody tries to differentiate on the things they're good at or bad at. And that's actually important for your whole career, let alone just a VC. Look, the second one is, do I think the people have good judgment? Have they been involved with things that get to scale? So as an LP, you think these VCs will likely have good judgment, be able to pick things that will get to interesting scale over other things. You know, and then the last thing is, you know, are they people that, you know, ultimately over time people will want to work with? Because I think, you know, VC-LP relationship is long-term, even longer-term than the VC-founder relationship. And so, you know, you want a VC who people are going to want to work with, not just today, but 5 years from now. And if you get somebody who is maybe has good taste and is in the flow, but will quickly get eliminated out of that for not being a good person, you don't want to be investing in. So
8 years from now, when we're back doing another podcast, what are the next generation of companies that we're going to be talking about that reach that, you know, Facebook scale or LinkedIn scale?
Yeah. You know, that's a great question. You know, right now it's sort of a free for all. This is sort of the first time, you know, in a long time that I haven't felt like there's something new that's on the horizon that's blowing up, even in the same way that Snapchat was. I mean, Facebook's just so good at connecting us, and Instagram's so good at letting us share photos. I think there's going to be something in VR, AR, that will become a defining way that a lot of us use the platform. Maybe it will come out of the Oculus team or the Sony team or the Valve team, or maybe it'll be something new that somebody will build that'll surprise us all. You know, I think gaming and esports is becoming a lot bigger. So I'm bullish on my investment in a company called Discord, and I think Twitch will be a lot bigger as well. I think we're going to see those ecosystems evolve to, you know, where they're going to be almost as big as actually professional sports in, you know, call it 10 years. I think there's going to be some stuff around health and biology that will be like something we're all going to talk about that will be affecting the world more than we think so. In the same way, if you'd asked 5 years ago and you're like, oh, this Uber thing is going to remake cities, I might never have said that, but now it's super obvious that, Uber's remade cities. So I think we'll see some things there. You know, and look, I still am excited about, you know, two companies I'm involved with, Nextdoor and Medium, I think are on the cusp of becoming one of those companies. Medium, where we read great content every single day, and where if you ever have a story you want to tell, you post it on Medium. And Nextdoor, which is remaking our neighborhoods and local cities in a really compelling way.
We may not know or appreciate, that the public may not know or appreciate about this person, and or somewhere where you have, you know, maybe a disagreement or difference of thought, difference of opinion.
Cool.
Biz Stone.
Now, Biz is the single best translator of the power of technology to something that feels fundamentally human that I've ever worked with. The way he was able to talk about Twitter and its importance for kind of humanity and just relate it to most normal people was unprecedented, and I think was something that even Facebook was not doing as well in that era.
Evan from Snapchat.
Look, I think he cares so deeply about the people using his products, the people he works with. And I think, you know, there's a reason that Snapchat doesn't have likes and hearts. It's because it created a negative pressure for your picture to have enough likes and hearts that it didn't count. And I think, you know, Evan just understands and cares about people not having that kind of negative pressure on them all the time. He really wants it to be much more authentic. And I think I think people don't understand how powerful and visceral that is in making Snapchat what it's become.
I want you to make a prediction, like Slack, you know, Stripe. I know you're a bit long on Who's. Is it Who's or How's?
How's.
What's the next big, you know, that's not an investment of yours? Yes. You can't plug an investment. Like, what's the next big company, next big founder that you're, you know, is going to be in that elite class?
No, I mean, there is something happening with Slack right now that it certainly has the potential to become a much bigger and much, much more important company. The way we communicate at work, you know, hasn't changed that much since email was introduced 20 years ago. And Slack, you know, IRC and chat and HipChat have been around, and Campfire have been around for a little while, but none of them really transform the workplace. Slack has that opportunity to. Opening up the right channels inside a company to be able to communicate. And whether that becomes a pattern that we actually want to bring back into our lives, there isn't really, WhatsApp is probably the way I've seen people use WhatsApp outside the US is the closest to using, you know, Slack channels. I think there's something really big there. You know, I love John and Sammy from Shots. They're great founders, and they've been hustling to build this authentic network that, you know, started with selfies. And now it's, how do we make each other laugh and how do we have fun? And I think they're, you know, I'm really hopeful that they're going to find something that becomes, you know, really big and important for the world and kind of this entertainment and authenticity.
When you think of like advice to, you know, yourself in 2011 as an investor, if you can go back to when you're starting out, you know, what is the Josh Allen 2016 you're telling him?
You should have bet on Snapchat. you know, I think it's stay in your lane. My lane has been products that help people connect and connect around media and connect around each other in the world. So stay in that lane and continue to find great companies and founders trying to move that forward. But I think it's get curious and go learn about a few more spaces. I've started investing in the Internet of Things and learning about that. You know, Bitcoin wasn't something that personally interested me. You know, I'm starting to learn a little bit more about what's happening around like the CRISPR ecosystem and health. I think it's continue to be curious, because one part of becoming a great investor is going to be finding stuff in your core domain that really turns out to hit it big. And one part is going to be finding new areas that are going to be as big as when you bet on social networking 10 years ago.
So obviously you've been a huge fan of Reed and David too, is mm-hmm. said has been a sort of hero for a long time. Talk about when you first realized that you wanted to, you know, that you admire David.
You know, it's funny. You know, David Z is sort of, he's not bombastic in the press, so I think he's a little bit less known than some of the other great VCs of the past 10 years. But in my opinion, you know, he's one of the very, very best. I mean, he invested in LinkedIn Series B, Facebook Series B, Pandora Series C, I think, you know, and has returned, you know, those investments collectively are worth billions of dollars now, you know, from when he made them. And that's kind of a super uber grand slam for a VC. And when I first met him, he was, you know, at LinkedIn, and he was been at Excite, which back then was a major search company. And he'd been one of the executives at Excite and had sort of been dabbling in some ad tech and enterprise investing, and kind of found LinkedIn and got to know Reed. And he was meeting some of the early people at LinkedIn, and we just got coffee. And he kind of was explaining to me why he was excited about LinkedIn and what he believed could happen with the company, and why he was excited about social networking, why he thought there might be a consumer internet renaissance. And you know, I thought, wow, this is a guy who's had a really successful career and is now a VC. And I wonder if someday I could grow up to be like that. And as I've gotten to know him over the years, I just haven't seen somebody who stays as thoughtful, as down to earth, you know, as humble in terms of helping companies and always really being behind the companies he's in to make them great. And, you know, watching Reed join David at Greylock was a sign to me that, like, their partnership was much, much deeper than just one about, you know, investing in the company, but really helping them build it together. And thought, gosh, I don't want to just be an investor. I really want to help founders build their companies.
Greylock is, you know, one of the best investors in the world that you, you know, look up to and learn from, you know, read everything they write, or,
you know, one of the ones that I've been most impressed with is Bill Gurley over at Benchmark. I think it's funny because he didn't come from a tech or product background. He was actually an analyst before, but I think his way of understanding the intricacies of how these like marketplaces and businesses emerge is really unprecedented. And it's not until you see Bill work privately that you even start to get a real sense of how deeply he understands the fundamental levers and models in these companies and in these products that make them work. I get to see Bill's on the board of Nextdoor, and I get to join some of the Nextdoor board meetings, and just watching the way that he pushes for certain motivating influences to cause the network and the neighborhood to grow, you know, just blow me away that he's able to think at that detailed level. And when you go read some of his writing about marketplaces, he's able to articulate these very complex concepts, you know, incredibly well. And, you know, gosh, you know, he saw Uber before anybody else and really bet that it could become this transportation network of the future. So huge credit for that decision. But I think we sometimes overcredit VCs for a investment decision versus their actual detailed day-to-day work and hands-on understanding of what it's about. And that's where he really blows me away.
How is like Benchmark pulled away as in like in terms of what they do, you know, how are they, we could talk about how great Greylock is all day and obviously yeah. It's in the top, but how is Benchmark so good at what they do and why?
You know, it's so funny because we talk about companies as like so great about what they do or you know, what's happening. And yet it really comes down to a couple of investments that turn out to be great. It's funny, you know, in 2011 or 12, this question was always about Greylock because we had Facebook, LinkedIn, Pandora, Workday, Palo Alto Networks going. You know, today people talk about Benchmark because they have, Uber and Snapchat, you know, is like, you know, and WeWork is like massive investments that will be great returns for the firm. And it's just always a cycle and a work in process. Fundamentally, the firms that really impressed me are ones like Sequoia and you know, Greylock and Benchmark that have been around for a long time, that have gone through generational change, that have really built a practice of entrepreneurs who say, that firm really helped me build my company into something big. And you know, we can't just look at the current investments and say, okay, all the hype goes to that, because it's a cycle and it's a process. And you know, sometimes you have hits and sometimes you don't, but the ones who have continually just done this year over year over year are the ones that really, you know, get me the most excited.
Going back to product management for a second, what do you think you've grown to understand about being a PM that isn't super commonly understood, or that most people don't think about, or that people have a big misconception?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think of the product manager as this guru leader who sets the vision for the product and drives everyone to go build it. And I just found in my career, the best product managers are the ones who can set a tone and set a cadence, and then really let the great ideas come from the team, from outside the team, collect them and articulate them and hone them into a thing that we go deliver. And I think I see a lot of people like, I want to be a product manager because I want to make the decisions and I want to be in charge and I want to be the CEO of the product is a term that I hear thrown around way too much. And I think all that's crap. I think the real trick is, can you be the type of person who loves the success of the team and loves sort of, I would say it's like being the guy in the back of the raft that you're just sort of steering a little bit in the river while everybody else is, you know, while the people around you are paddling as hard as they can. And if you do that work, then you know, you've made your team a lot more successful.
If you were the CEO of Twitter, what would you?
You know, I'm excited to see what Jack does back in the company. I think that they have a massive opportunity to help people discover stuff they care about that right now it's still too hard. If I want to set up my Twitter, I call it tuning your Twitter. It's really hard to find the individuals that I want to follow that makes my Twitter perfect. I think if they can figure out how to get you to express Twitter as a set of topics or interests or things that you care about in the world, that Twitter can deliver you these incredible streams of content around, I think Twitter will be, you know, a place that even more people will get the same kind of experience I do every day out of Twitter. So I'd love to see them figure that out. And I think that I'm excited to see all the stuff they can do around live, both with Periscope, with live events happening in the world. Twitter's still where you want to go in the moment when anything's happening. There's a lot they can do to catalyze that even more.
A couple of people have questions about non-tech founders to get, to recruit technical founders or to sort of, you know, how to present themselves or what advice you'd give to non-technical aspiring founders.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the best founding teams have a combination of hustle and think and idea and vision for what we want to do in the world and ability to sketch it out, always combined with somebody who's super excited to be their partner in shaping that vision and actually building it and delivering it. And so I see non-technical founders like, how can I hire an engineer? And I think that never works. I think it's, how can I find a partner who's excited with me about this vision? And my skills are going to have to be designing and hustling and finding people out there. And this guy's skills are going to be actually coding it. And together, we're going to shape it together. And they're going to be a true partner. When those happen, it ends up being really successful. Look at Kevin and Mikey from Instagram. Look at Evan and Bobby at Snapchat. Like, these are all great partnerships that are true partnerships, not just, hey, where can I go hire a cheap engineer to do my work?
If you had to start a fund, in what sort of space would you start it in? If it had a specific space or stage, or you know, where do you think the opportunity is?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think a lot about institutions. As I said, I'm a joiner. Part of the reason I joined Greylock is Greylock's 50 years old, was around before I was born. And God help me, I hope we put, you know, I'm part of putting Greylock in a place where it's around, you know, well after me, because I believe in institutions that live and survive a long time. If I had to start a new fund, I would think about how I can start a fund like that. And I would focus on Series A. I think the Series A and B stage, you know, is just an exceptional time to get involved in a company where the seed stage is figuring out if something will work. At A and B, you're saying, hey, we have this thing that we believe will work, that believe we should be really important in the world. Let's set up a company that's built to last. And there's nothing more fun than kind of the early stages of laying the groundwork for built to last. I would stay in software. I think, you know, consumer I think consumer and enterprise software and a little bit of hardware is sort of a great spot to be in.
Yeah. And in terms of like, you're going to be an investor for a long time. What do you want to look back at you? And this will end with this. What do you want to look back at your career in terms of like legacy or in terms of, you know, what you've accomplished?
You know, it's a great question. And I believe I really want to help people make things that matter in the world and deliver a ton of value to users and want to keep doing that. Right now in my role as an investor, I get to do that by investing, joining the boards of companies that can do that and being part of them for the long term. That's incredible. And I have my shot to do that. If it turns out I'm not a very good investor or I'm not great at actually helping companies, you know, achieve that or finding the right ones to do it to generate the right returns for LPs, then maybe the best way for me to do it will be to go back and get a job at a company where I can still do that and reach that scale. But I want to keep doing the same thing, help companies build products that matter, that get to scale. And I'm going to do that in whatever form I can. And, you know, right now I have the shot to do that as an investor and build a great career doing it in this role. And I'm sure hopeful that I can make it.
They're all competing over you. and every company wanted Josh Ellman, as I'm sure they would, who would you join? Snapchat, Facebook? You
know, I am. I always like the things that still can grow a lot bigger. So, you know, I'm excited by a lot of companies right now. I'm super happy with my friend Tom Conrad, who just joined Snapchat as the head of product there. I think it's an exceptional fit for him and for them. I'm super bullish on companies like Nextdoor Medium. Any of my investments, I could see joining, you know, if it came to that, because I wouldn't have invested if I didn't want to go work there.
Perfect. That's perfect. And a note to end on. Lastly, I just want to give you an opportunity to send any plugs. You know, where can people learn more about you or find you online or more about Greylock or anything you guys have?
Look, if you ever want to get in touch with me, I'm josh@greylock.com. I'm mediocre at responding to email, but I try to read everything. Tweet me at Josh Ellman, read my stuff. I blog on Medium. And if you have stuff to say that you want to share with the world, I ask everyone to blog that back on Medium.
Josh, it has been an honor and a pleasure. You are a friend, supporter, and investor of Product Hunt. And again, one of the best guys in the biz. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me, Eric.